Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And this is a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. In today's episode, we'll be speaking with Jonathan Wright about a lot of things, but mainly why test automation is broken. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. Do you have a sinking feeling that your test automation efforts aren't quite right? When looking around in the industry, are you starting to see that everyone else is facing the same exact issues? Let's face it, there is something fundamentally wrong with the way most of us are approaching testing and automation. There are a lot of digital disruptions coming that are going to force us to change the way we think about testing and automation. It's a brave new world for testers, so get ready to learn how to do testing in the wild with Jonathan Wright leading the way. Jonathan covers a lot of things in this episode, so I have a special offer for you. So if you want to learn more about building an intelligent system for the cloud, big data on Amazon Web Services, domain-driven design fundamentals, all the things that John talks about in this episode, leave a comment within the show notes at www.testtalks.com/38, and I will randomly choose 5 people to receive 1 month of unlimited access to some video training courses. So check it out. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to Test Talks.
Hi, Test Talks. It's Jonathan from the north of London, so I'm really pleased to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. So before we get started, though, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. So I've been doing test automation for just over 15 years. I kind of started at the back end of the 90s, and that was in the age of XRunner and WinRunner. So did a bit of UI automation. I've then been moving on to all sorts of things. But over the last kind of last year, I've been focusing mainly around API testing in the cloud, but also test automation as a service. So that's been something that I've been focused on for the last 5 years. And that's really bringing test automation into the cloud or into cloud environments. So that's what I've been pretty much doing for the last 15 years. But I've been going a little bit wider in Agile and DevOps and everything that comes along. So there's a lot of interesting new opportunities, I think, especially in 2015. So plenty to talk about.
Awesome. So I'd like to start off talking about test automation as a service. In a nutshell, what is test automation as a service?
So test automation as a service is really a cloud-based view. So this is something I started as a bit of a project to get myself up to speed about 5 years ago. And that was looking at making everything more service-orientated architecture. So what I'd learned for the prior 10 years was all around your traditional approaches to modular, data-driven, keyword-driven, hybrid kind of approaches. And I kind of thought, well, why don't we move that into the cloud environment or design something that was specifically born in the cloud? So this was focused on Azure, Amazon Web Services, the platforms which everyone has access to, and then look at how we'd actually scale test automation into a cloud environment. I think it's sometimes referred to as high volume automated testing or high volume mobile testing if you're doing it from a mobile point of view. But yeah, so it was around service oriented architecture. So everything was a service. So the scheduler was a service, the results was a service, and you literally could just change whatever you wanted to scale it up and provide a platform and a infrastructure as a service, but allow you to dynamically spin up test automation at scale, really, but more from a consumerization where you can actually go in there, design tests, be agnostic to technology or platform, natural language, et cetera. So it's a very interesting challenge and something that we've been working on for 5 years now, he was lucky enough to win the Google Innovation Awards in the UK for looking at test automation as a service. So that was really looking at, you know, how we actually look at scaling this out to people and let the community own the community cloud and use, take advantage of some of these services.
So I'm trying to wrap my head around this. When mm-hmm. you say as a service, so I would log into the site and I would mm-hmm. be able to actually develop my test scripts and then run them within this environment and be able to scale up depending on, you know, how many servers I need and things like that.
Sure. So I think the easiest way, you've got your own kind of dashboard. So the idea behind this is, you know, this is a service, test community service. So it would be open to a testing marketplace. So the idea is, you use the word best of breeds, but it would be a collaboration between technology vendors such as Microsoft, HP, etc., who'd all provide as a service, so flexible licensing, flexible models. This wasn't designed specifically for one company. It was more designed for the community to actually take ownership for and start building services, niche services. So I think we touched slightly on performance, but the idea was they were going to be agnostic. So you could use them for security testing, penetration testing, performance testing, UI testing, API testing, all as part of a single platform. I think this was a bit of a change from the traditional way where these are all usually standalone services that are done in isolation and they don't reuse the same test assets. So the idea was exactly what you just said. You'd log in and you'd go in and there'd be an editor, and that editor would be driven by your methodology you use. So if it was Agile, you'd see them as stories. You know, potentially if you was deciding to do ATDD, they'd have acceptance criteria mapped to them. If you was going down the BDD front for with Dan North stuff, you'd have behaviors mapped to that. Well, however you decide to design your assets, whether that's, you know, the traditional waterfall or modern day agile approaches, you know, DAD, less safe, which all these kind of frameworks that people are starting to adopt, the idea is you could put your test assets in the same format. So they wasn't specific to, like you would get with test-driven delivery, where it would be an executable specification. It'd be content-sensitive driven. So the idea is it'd only be able to provide you with values of something that existed. And really, when we start talking about API testing and obviously kind of stubs and shims and service virtualization, you're talking about potentially there isn't an application to be there. So I think we'll talk about first day automation, which has kind of been one of the topics that I covered in the Experiences of Test Automation book with Dorothy. But, you know, partly this was a way of creating test assets that were using content-sensitive validation against a model that was defined of the application. So this is where we really went into business process modeling, business process scenarios. So taking things like XAML files, which was XPDL, you could turn them into XPDL formats and then model your particular application under test or solution under test and all the dependencies, and then write valid tests in whatever format you wanted to against that particular application. And then you would have a number of different components. And these are kind of things which have moved away from the traditional object repository, which has kind of evolved over time. So we're all used to using things like descriptive programming, et cetera, instead of using static object repositories. But this would be use things like test asset scrapers. So this would be a way of when the code is built at runtime, it would go off and discover the different routes with the application. And this is done on with some very basic fuzzy logic, which is kind of understanding container models, understanding what's not being mapped. And obviously this is language specific as well. So the idea is you can test in multi-language as well. So you're not building object repositories that are for a particular application or a particular version or a particular language. They're dynamically generated based on natural language. And the idea was you take those things like asset loaders, you take that validation against models that you've generated, you'd write valid tests. And then the idea is you'd then schedule and run those tests and you'd be able to scale up. You'd be able to reuse those tests for performance or API or et cetera, et cetera. The idea was to give a bit more flexibility. And a lot of this was around things like, you know, standards, which are yet to really have arrived because of the way that the sheer amount of different test automation tools that people use today. There is no standard for how you would express test data, even though there is metadata and mathematics which you can easily use to express these forms. So this is where, you know, I've been lucky enough to be working with people like Grid Tools, who've got do a lot around there for things like Agile Designer, which are more based on mathematics. They're Oxford University guys, so they're just physics and maths. So it's a lot around cause and effect, quantum computing, quantum modeling, all that kind of stuff that really allows us to build realistic models and generate tests out the back of that. So in a way, it was a very interesting new way of looking at things, but the principles are extremely simple. And, you know, anyone can design a test because the test asset scraper is generating what the application looks like. You're pretty much just dragging which components you want to use and how to make them into reusable objects. So, you know, it was just a different way of looking at it. And out of the back of this came really testing as a service, and then test automation as a service, test infrastructure as a service, test platform as a service, which is, again, exactly really what I've been talking about, which was more about providing a platform where best of breed tools can be provided available as part of a testing marketplace. And then you would just literally, I use the just-in-time delivery, but the idea is you could plug in a really good reporting tool or a really good visualization tool for, you know, business modeling, and then you'd consume it on a licensing model instead of having to go through and pay for things before you actually consume them, which is the old model of you buy a product, does it work for you? Or does it work for you for a small amount of time? And then something better comes along and you kind of think, oh, well, it was previously all TSL and now I'm going to have to move to VBS, or if I'm going from VBS and I want to go to C#, then potentially those scripts aren't as portable. So we've been looking at ways of dealing with this from a community side of things. So that's really tested as a service in the executive 10 minutes kind of approach.
Cool. So I just want to give an example to see if sure. I understand correctly. So say I have a behavior-driven development framework and it uses JBehave and Selenium. But then as I'm testing, I realize that, you know, this is a browser application, but it invokes thick client applications. And so, of course, Selenium can't handle that. So I need to find another tool then that can handle the thick client piece. That if I use the test automation as a service, with the flexibility that I could say, I know now that I need a thick client application tool that can automate this for me. And I have a list of choices then that I could choose in order to use to automate that piece.
Yeah, and it's even scarier than that, actually, because it does this at runtime. So the idea is when it builds the actual instance, which it does the testing in, it builds the test, it chooses the correct test adapter at runtime. So whether or not you're doing load, regression, penetration, browser, thick client, thin client, it will choose based on the container models, which it's looking at, what is the best tool to actually do the activity you want. Now this is quite interesting from two sides of things. So where this has actually worked, and I've seen this working for a client, was we were finding we had challenges around a Web 2.0 technology like Flex. Now, they had different container models for different objects. And this meant that actually certain tools, completely different tools, would have better support and capabilities around different objects like tables or, you know, more complex charting components. So instead of kicking off a script and then being limited to that test adapter, let's just say WebDriver, and you've not included a new adapter which you need, which for obviously for Flex it's a bit more challenging because you've got to expose the container models and recompile it first. But in that particular instance, we had two choices at runtime. We had a Ranarex test adapter and we had a Telerik test adapter. And what we would literally do is as it was interacting or it was trying to investigate what it was trying to interact with, it would say, okay, let me have a look. Actually, I've gone down the container model with a certain amount of accuracy. I see three buttons on the screen. I can only interact with one of them. Two of these classes are unknown. Okay, so I'm going to use this adapter to click on that button. But then the next two, at that point in time, it will actually try and do two things. First of all, it'll do what you do with Windows when you try and boot up and it goes wrong. It says, shall I use the last known configuration? And at that point in time, it will say, what did I do last time? And at that point, it might say, well, actually, I used the same Ranarex adapter, but this time was a previous version. It was actually version 3 of the test adapter. So it'll actually unload the latest version, reload the older version and say, can I see the container model? And the answer will be, no, you still can't. And at that point, it will then try again to actually go into something like Telerik or another test adapter to actually discover that. Now, obviously, that we all know that potentially that could fail as much as the traditional approach of object recognition would fail. So this is where I think when we talk about mobile automation, we've started going between image recognition. You know, they use the word hybrid object recognition, but really this is kind of saying, actually, as much as I don't want to go back to the days where it was analog, you know, the idea is if it can see image recognition and you can use something like eggplant, then actually you can look at it based on an image. So, you know, the whole thing is we're not completely limited by our technology. And partly what we want to write, how, when I use the word natural language with content sensitive validation, what I'm talking about is the ability to validate against a model of an application which you do not care about the technology that's used to implement this. And I've seen, you know, over the many years, and I've got a client, actually the client I'm going to see on Monday, who's moving away from Flex 3.5, they're moving to 4, and then they're moving to Web Focus. So the idea is the business model won't change. They're still going to do what they normally do. The difference is the reports will change from these pretty patchy Flex kind of base ones, or Adobe Flex as it used to be, to a Web Focus. And, you know, we all understand why they're doing that. We understand they're doing that because they want to be HTML5. But at the end of the day, they don't want to throw away their old test automation assets. They want to just be able to be agnostic. So the same business processes are running, the same reporting with the same importance on data, where we're saying, actually, like Paul Gerard kind of said in his paper on a new model for testing last year, he said, actually, it doesn't matter now. It doesn't matter what the technology is, because at the end of the day, we know that's just a presentation layer. And in a way, we can actually generate that presentation without actually seeing the application, which is what we're going to talk about in first day automation. But the concept is that actually, when it comes to the presentation layer, actually, that's no longer the most important component. And this is a bit of a change from the traditional test automation focusing on UI and test automation focusing on API testing, or, you know, you could call it database, you know, the middleware, you know, that kind of stuff. And we all know when it comes to things like Flex, that Flex is just the framework which sits on top, that actually it's Flex Data Services, which is just pure XML that's sending it to the client, to that thick client or thin client. So partly, if we can inject, we can capture at the API level, we can see what information is going to be presented on the presentation layer anyway. And then if we go steps further back, we'll actually see that that information is being generated from a database query where it's gone through and got some records that it wants to put in a chart. And actually, we can trace that all the way back a little bit further. So actually, now when I think about test automation, I don't think about the end presentation state so much. And someone said to me the other day about mobile first development, saying that we actually build an application to work on a phone first, then to whatever other type of application. I actually take the James Whittaker's view on the fact. So he stood up at ADP West last year and said, in 5 years' time, there will be no apps. And that's a really dangerous and scary kind of principle, because he literally, working in Microsoft, he demonstrated just going into his calendar, right-clicking and saying, I want to fly to Munich on Monday or Vegas or wherever it may be. And it would go off, it would understand, you know, it could call APIs that book his flights. It could understand the traffic, what from his house to the airport, what the check-in times are. It booked the taxi using Uber or whatever it may be. It found in the best flight, it based on, you know, the rewards and the systems that he uses as a regular trending flyer. It probably used Seat Guru to work out which seat he'd prefer. It would then go and book that. It'd take his payment details based on his Microsoft corporate card. It'd work out his landing time. It'd book him in his favorite hotel. And at the end of the day, all he's put, which is the whole really idea of Web 2.0, is I would like to go to Vegas. And, you know, I think this is a wonderful place to be. But, you know, for businesses, actually, they don't care about what the app looks like. Well, they do to a certain point when it comes to, you know, what's the end user UX experience, which doesn't seem to be included in, well, it's not going to be included by automation anyway. But it, from a core business point of view, they just want to make sure they're giving the right information in the right data. So we're now moving from being testers to be data scientists. And I think this is why we're looking at it in a slightly different way. So hopefully that's kind of expanded in a lot more detail, but why, you know, test adapters and technology and platform, or even when we're talking about mobile or a web, or maybe we're talking about alter reality, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. That's just an interface that the human can interface with the computer. You know, we're hoping to remove quite a lot of that dependency in the future.
I'll tell you the honest truth, Jonathan. You're blowing my mind here. So I need to really research this a little bit more. And it sounds awesome. Strange new world, actually, for an automation engineer.
Well, it is. And, you know, I'll take this a step further in the sense of, you know, the projects that I'm working on at the moment are nuclear power and smart cities. And, you know, the when it comes into IoT, you know, the scary thing, which you may have seen some of the material I put together for tests as a service models, the discussion paper, I was talking that actually last year there's more mobile devices, active mobile devices, than the people on the planet, which is 7.2 million mobile devices. Now, it's actually taken quite a long time for that to get to that point. And, you know, it doesn't surprise anybody. But when we come to machine-to-machine interfaces, which is the whole concept behind Internet of Things, actually there's something around 300 million, but it's growing at such a faster rate than mobile ever did. So to the point where mobile at least is a human component where we're interacting with applications and services, soon we're talking about Internet of Things, we're talking about smart cities, we're talking about the ability where, for instance, at one of the company I'm working for now, Hitachi, we have self-drive diggers. So they go off and they go in the morning, they go and they've got some kind of input saying, we'd like these resources mining. It will go off, it will mine that information, it will take them all to the different locations, manufacturing plants, etc., just in time, all very lean. And, you know, that those resources will then go through some manufacturing process and maybe it'll come out with something like concrete. And then the smart city will be understanding that the roads actually need repaving, and these machines will then, you know, the next generation will be going out there and relaying the roads, you know, and the infrastructures. And we're dealing with things like water purification, dealing with, in this particular case, we're doing Copenhagen's carbon neutral by 2025. So we're looking at smarter ways to use traffic systems. I think the IoT thing is now coming in a big way. And I know Paul Gerard has quite a bit to say about how you go and test Internet of Things. And I think when we talk about IoT, we are talking about hardware more than we are about software. And I think that's going to be a cultural change for testers, as they've been so reliant on software testing and not really that much on getting involved at a hardware layer. And, you know, I think this is going to be a big change for everyone as well in those kind of areas.
Awesome. Now, I did some research earlier this year and I did my predictions for 2015. And Internet of Things was one of those things that it's been going on, but I think it's really going to, in the next few years, really take off. So sure. What do you recommend a test engineer now focuses on in order to be ready for the next 5 years of their career?
Well, I could literally tell you what my abstract is, which I just submitted today. And the idea behind it is pretty much exactly the question that you've just asked. And I kind of said, okay, what's changing? And I'll literally read it. It's quite easy things. I say, you know, part of it is dealing with real world scenarios in a bigger way. So I use the testing in the wild in a very scary kind of way. But the idea is things like near far communications, you know, Apple Pay. You know, part of it is we're getting new challenges that are coming through in the software world, which actually needs us to be in the real world and actually test real systems in the real world, both mission critical for things like nuclear power, which, interestingly enough, for that project, one of their big areas was, you know, mobile. And you kind of think to yourself, okay, well, why are we doing mobile testing for a nuclear plant? I thought Homer just sat there with the big green button and was not told not to press it. The IT director for Fusion projects that turned around to me and said, well, it's because now we won't have screens because they potentially can go wrong. We won't have dials. We'll have devices, and those devices will be geo-based. And when people walk from one reactor location to another, they'll get all the latest information about what's going on in that room, who's working on what problem. It will be based on a lot more things than just screens and software. It will be more interactive. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be bring your own device, but it's definitely going to be getting to that point where, and I use the word MI5 for over here, but you could go CIA's kind of technology level over there. You know, part of it now is looking at, which is the stuff that I put down, you know, smart cities, augmented reality. You know, Google Cardboard is £25, you know, or $25 in the States. You literally, people are starting to have that capability where, you know, what's the limitation of, you know, interacting with objects or other people based on, you know, two dimensions? We're now going into three dimensions. You've got the Microsoft HoloLens, which is talking about actually being able to map your entire environment in front of you so you can interact with it. You can build objects. You can test things in a Minority Report kind of way. You know, I go into what should they be learning? Well, in this particular instance, I'm talking about things like model-driven delivery. So a lot of understanding models. And that really goes back to Paul Gerard's paper on a new model for testing. But it's how we as people use models. And that really goes then back into systems dynamics and systems thinking. So that's another very interesting area, which, again, would have to be a much wider discussion. But it's a new way where testers are having to think about how they apply that model. And then things like obviously the new frameworks that are coming through for safe, DAD, less, plus things like the new ISO testing standard, which is the 29119, you know, how's that going to impact them? So, you know, there's a lot of, I use the word digital disruption and digital enterprise. There's a lot of stuff coming through where mobile apps are no longer about just mobile apps that are out in the wild that people will give a rating 1 to 5. They are about, you know, health companies using them to monitor, you know, critical data, you know, businesses using them internally to deliver whatever their product is. The same tools that we need to test and are still there, and the same methodologies and classification trees. If, you know, Julie Gardner was talking, you know, the same principles are there. You know, if somebody doing exploratory testing, the difference is we'll be using, you know, Google Glasses, walking around testing footfalls on different shopping centers and seeing how actually we could position better marketing material, or, you know, using all this information in a slightly different environment than just clicking login details, username, password, okay. You know, I think, you know, things are going to get a lot more complex a lot quicker.
Right. I think you mentioned something earlier, and that I think is really profound, that we're going to become more like data analysts. We're going to have sensors everywhere. We're going to have all this data. So what do we do with this data? How do we analyze this data? How can we get metrics and get things out of this data? So I think that was a skill most of us definitely need to work on.
Sure. So this is one of the things. When I went back to slightly talking about quantum mechanics, partly that stuff was about cause and effect modeling to understand big data. You know, part of the way we do it at the moment is we say we can't test big data, it's too big, but we can definitely test small data, which means that we have to apply those meta mathematics and meta languages to a particular model to say, what is the data that I'm expecting to flow through here? How do I model that data? And how do I get that information into a way that I can use it? But also, how can I test those complex analytic systems? So those BI systems, those MI systems, you know, the stuff which we've been doing a long time before, but really now big data's kind of in its explosion stage. And, you know, we deal with Oracle and Microsoft as one of our two technology partners, and what's coming along for us, and I know stuff what James Whitaker's working on out in Seattle, is really going to be, how do we actually test those things? How do we test those sheer volumes? You know, how do we do it in, and I use the word cloud, but I use it because, you know, sometimes we're talking about scale and things like Oracle. You know, part of it is Oracle offer ways of looking at a bit like, I use the word Netflix for databases, but the idea is we can't rely on having to clear down 430 terabyte databases, test databases anymore, because it will just take too long. So partly is we want the kind of the multicast view of a testing database, which allows one user or one automation script to be able to make an effect to that. And that's where SV and NV really comes into its place. So service virtualization, network virtualization, because it's great testing this stuff, but if we can't be realistic about it, we can't deal with things like systemic failure, then we've got a problem. So, you know, I'm talking to another key large company who do food suppliers, and they use Facebook as their login API. And I talked at Star West about systemic failure and the fact that these large ecosystems are always tested in isolation. And Julie kind of gave me that quote. But it was the idea that, you know, you may decide that Facebook is your API for single sign-on, but what happens when Facebook goes down? And obviously last week it did. You know, part of that is that will have a catastrophic failure for all the service providers that actually use that as the logging system. So, you know, part of it is it's a good idea at the time, but you've got to be able to deal with degradation of the service. This is where we go into testing in the live. We talk about, I use the word test ops because I think DevOps and dev in test seems the wrong thing to be talking about as testers. But, you know, part of testing in the wild is we see this information happening in real time. You know, the old days, Google Analytics was fine to happen, you know, to get information a day after it had happened. But really now we're looking at things like AppPulse from HP or Soaster's product, which allows us to actually see what's happening in the wild right now, down to the level where we can literally see the person walking along the road trying to make an order, and we can see the journey time he's going through, or she is, and literally going, okay, his time to live's dropping, you know, his network switched from a strong 4G to a 3G as he walks under the bridge. Actually, there's some packet loss going on there. actually he's just got on the tube. He's definitely not going to be able to submit that. And suddenly, you know, there's a new, as there was yesterday or the day before, there was a new iOS release, which included testing standardization for training, well, whatever that means, but for education, whichever that means. But that might have had a discrete effect based on a new Safari release, a new security patch, a new way that the hardware layer actually on the ARM chip is working, that then affects certain users with certain applications who are less than 40% battery. You know, unless you're using things like Microsoft Operations Manager or some kind of tool that's giving you this instant information about real users and real scenarios, then, you know, what I seem to see at the moment is that they just go into chaos and they go and try and fix everything and they can't reproduce it in their test environments because it's too complex, and it only happens to a certain user class. So therefore, really, those DevOps and TestOp opportunities are really to say, okay, well, let's just push out this small change, which literally just tells users on who are trying to use Google Chrome on an iPhone to use Safari, instead of coming up with an error message that says, this is an unsecure network, we've not, please check your device, it may be a security risk. You know, part of it is changing it, so people still do the payment, we still get, you know, that, but it's happening in the same day. And you get, I talked to a CIO the other day who said, I want to embrace DevOps. And he said, I want to do 27 to 50 releases a day. I know people like Bing do that every day already, but they have a much more mature testing strategy. Whereas, and people like Alan Page are running that for Bing. But, you know, they're just not doing it for organizations that want to make those changes, which could potentially bring their product down. You know, it's a lot more difficult than it was before. And testing always comes in too late, but now actually testing in the wild is going to be something we see a lot more, and being able to make decisions based on, I use the word actionable insight, but real information that's telling us, you know, real journeys and where they're going wrong and why they're going wrong and on what device, in what location, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is going to be a lot more important.
Awesome. So are there any resources or books you would recommend to help someone learn more about these newer technologies and approaches?
That would be the most wonderful thing in the world, I think. So I spent 5 years doing test automation in the cloud primarily, and every time I've met anybody, I spoke at Gartner last year, and I think they definitely, from a trending point of view, Gartner and everyone else, is this year they're talking about business process modeling and stuff in a big way. Last year it was all about organizations turning away from having applications to services, you know, dealing with just portfolios of API services. You know, that is actually their business now. It's not building a standalone app for a particular thing. So the trends are there. The trends in the industry are there. You know, everyone seems to recognize it. And obviously there's a lot of tool vendors that will write good, interesting case studies around how they deal with, you know, continuous build and integration or continuous build and iteration in the cloud, in mobile. So for people like Perfecto Mobile, I know I've got a lot of interesting stuff talking about that at the moment. But when it comes to a book or a guide or a way to kind of just solve these problems, I kind of look to the community. And I kind of, you know, one of the things that I've always been working on and being really passionate about is patterns. And, you know, Dorothy Graham released last year a Wikipedia site, or it was actually called Wikispaces. And that Wikispaces, which I can provide you a link at the end, was just a Wikipedia for test patterns. And it had design patterns, analysis patterns, development patterns, deployment patterns, management patterns, transition patterns, but based on what works in a three-dimensional way. So it's no longer domain specific. So it could be, I mean, like, we could be talking about technology domain for a second, but we could be talking about investment banking, derivatives, FX. It could be, you know, the context-driven world, which we also see from people like James Bark, Michael Bolton. You know, there's that view, the industry that they're in, the technology stack they're using, and the moment of time, and what I like to use called maturity. So I've been working a lot, again, with Dorothy on things like maturity models to say, well, actually, a bit like CMMI, TMMI, and I use the word AMMI for automation, I kind of saying, well, actually, at the start, you might be just wanting to accelerate. You might be wanting to get into DevOps, and you might just want to get the infrastructure in place. You might want to start building some very lightweight stuff. But then once you've done that, you're going to start seeing the pain, which is the whole thing about test automation, really. And I don't want to just limit to test automation, but it's typically what you're seeing is maintenance. You know, maybe that wasn't the best way of doing it. And part of the test automation, the experiences of test automation book, which is one that I'd recommend, but that's mainly retrospectives of people and industries and how they've dealt with problems. But the back of my case study really said, you know, everything I've just said is great, which I was talking about first day automation, but it's continuously evolving. So I would expect you're no longer to have test strategy documents, but more to have blueprint documents and charters, very dynamic ones that can change. And equally, it's not just one solution that fits all. It's what works for you. And that's where Dorothy's patterns was saying, this has worked for me in this particular circumstances. These patterns worked. And then it has a link to other patterns that have worked around that, or you could try. And, you know, part of it is there is no one solution. So I think we've got to, as a community, we've got to learn to kind of push some of that stuff back up. And I know these forums, I think they're a great place for collaboration. And I also think, you know, it's great to have things like conferences, but as far as an enterprise collaboration platform where we can all start, and I use the word test, the test community cloud, where we can actually start sharing those experiences. I don't think they're specific to a company anymore or an individual. I think they need to be shared so that we can kind of look at it and go, actually, yeah, you know, I'm trying to get better or better at prediction. So I know obviously there's certain things I can say and certain things I can't say, but, you know, HP this year are moving in a huge direction. Obviously, Apps 12 for them last year was a big year, but I was in Barcelona. I spoke at Barcelona last year for their HP Discover. And their R&D, as always, I try and keep in touch with their R&D department. And they were saying, well, you know, the new version of ALM will be completely, it'll be a whole new change, game changer. And they actually had a keynote on it, and it was around, you know, prediction. It was all about the fact you log in and it kind of says, this week you're going to get 15 defects, you're going to have, you know, you're going to have these kind of blockers. And it knows before you actually go into it. It actually starts, you can start looking at prediction more than just, you know, using trending and an analysis and all these great techniques. So I think, you know, the industry knows it's there. Is anybody writing about it? Yeah, there's loads of great books out there. You know, there's people like Elizabeth Hendrickson who've got loads of great books, and everyone else has. But, you know, I don't think they all bring the complete picture together. And this is where I tried to coin the concept of, instead of the software development lifecycle, we should really be moving into more of a solution delivery lifecycle integration, which is all around integration with other teams apart from test, devs, DevOps, shift left, shift right, shift up, shift down. You know, part of it is it's no longer an isolated component testing. And if we are talking about enterprise agile, we're talking about organization agile and distributed agile, then really that means that we actually need to be able to be in the set on the same platform as everybody else, including CIOs and CTOs. You know, it doesn't come down to that. It also pushes down to the customer and how quickly we can get that feedback loop in. I think now is a very brave new world, and searching for the word test and reading a book on test may not be the best thing. Actually, now we're looking at a much wider picture, and we need to get involved with a wider community as well.
Sometimes I think a lot of people have their heads so far in the weeds when they're doing automation and focusing on the implementation of their framework that they don't have time, or they don't pop their heads out and look around and see what's going on around in the test community to see, you know, what things are changing, to really address the bigger picture things rather than these little low level, I need to get this done this week, and who cares if a year from now this is all going to change.
Absolutely. And I think this is another thing back to the experiences in test automation, but one of the most useful things that Dorothy and Matt put in it was actually at the start, he said, this is the kind of environment it is. You know, it's financial, you know, it used these kind of tools. It had this kind of client server environment. And then at the end it said, is the automation still working? And, you know, part of it was, I think the old tradition, which happened in the 90s and maybe when automations first started off, you know, it was, this became shelfware, because what was happening was people weren't using the tools correctly, or they'd use them and they'd have limited success. And the vendors would be really happy to kind of sell you an expensive product, maybe get it working with a couple of scripts. But when you went off to go and do that yourself, it then didn't really have success. You ended up putting it back on the shelf. And I think, you know, when I talked a little bit about the context domain and technology platform, I spoke to a couple of the vendors at Eurostar last year, and I said, actually, you should stop selling these products. You should actually say, you need to show me your license, your product license. And part of that was, would you let anyone just get into your car and drive? And, you know, part of them is sometimes these testers or whoever uses it, the consumer, needs to have the right level of skill to make that a success. And I think it's so easy to just give someone a flashy tool and say, this will solve the problem. And we all know that's not going to work. But what's more important is that they understand the domain, A, they understand the context, you know, the training around automation or their industry. But then they also need to understand the technologies. They need to understand, so if it's a Microsoft technology and they're using Microsoft Test Manager, TFS, and they're using something like Coded UI to do the automation, then they need to understand, A, the limitations of using that tool, how to implement frameworks, you know, whether or not they choose to use C# or VB.NET, doesn't matter. You know, part of it is design patterns, reusable design patterns that are, you know, maintainable, reusable, scalable, you know, all the basic principles of what automation is all about before you just go in there. And then what we find is very limited success. And I think what we find even more now, which is the most upsetting thing in the world, is once it moves into continuous integration, we then start getting builds failing. We say, okay, so we got 8,000 unit tests, 4,000 integration tests, 2,000 UI tests. What do they mean? You know, what does it mean when they fail? And most of the time, I've seen people just throwing stuff away because they can't trace it back to a requirement or a story or a theme or an epic. You know, that traceability is gone. So, you know, part of it is if you're going to try to add value, and this is where I really like the idea of mod-driven delivery, is that actually, you know what the model of your application is. You know the critical processes you've got to go through. The business understands what it needs to do. You know, part of it is you need to model that back up and understand it. So that way you are writing, I don't want to use the word the perfect test, but you're definitely removing the traditional approach of creating login scripts more than once. But, you know, let's not use the word login scripts for an application. Let's use login scripts as a much more abstract model component that doesn't matter if it's LDAP, or it's some kind of login server, you know, front end, or it's a single sign on. It could be multiple applications. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. We all know how they work. The domain language, the meta language, might have changed a little bit. You know, one might say login, one might say log on, one might say apply or go through some extra steps. But we can model that, you know, very easily and then make these things a lot more reusable than going in there and trying to implement frameworks, which is my pet hate. I had a bit of a Star West last year and I kind of said, okay, what do we need to do? Well, the year before that, my controversial statement was ban all email because it's just static information. But then last year was, you know, ban frameworks because, you know, we're all rebuilding the same thing in essence. And this is that person who doesn't put their head up. They're just sat there saying, I found Gherkin or I found some cool new tool that I've heard about at a conference. I'm going to make an implementation of that. They don't look at any kind of larger structure of how they can include that as part of an end-to-end process. It's literally they want to play around with it and they may get bored, may have some limited success with it. You know, I think we've got to go into that point where we say, let's not build these monolithic frameworks, which are data-driven, keyword-driven, third generation, fourth generation, fifth generation. Let's go into the cloud. Let's move that so people can consume those services. And I don't actually mind the pay-as-you-use model. If it's best of breed and there's a great application or a great platform that I can take advantage of, and in a way, partly, I don't want to be hooked into that platform. So it needs to be an abstracted level away from that. Now, you know, Google have a black ops team which says, you know, as easy as you can put information in, you must be able to get it out. You know, equally, if I put my logic in there and my test data and my keywords, I don't want to be built into HP UFT as much as I love it. Originally when we talked about the UFT book that I did at the end of last year, that one of the big changes on UFT 12 was really to include service testing, so API testing. But really what happened there was they really added in, they merged the two products, and what that meant was there's a view which is just the flow through the application. So if the login fails, do the password reminder. If it's a new user, go down here, use BPT components all hooked up into ALM, ALI, you know, all these kind of great technologies. You're kind of thinking, that's great, but I don't want to just be stuck in HP. And the great thing is that, you know, HP then kind of said, well, we're not going to do that. You know, part of it is we're actually now going to support Microsoft, so you can build it as part of the Visual Studio if you want to. You know, part of ALI is, you know, you can have it running in Jenkins or you can have it in Team City or TFS. We don't mind. You know, we're actually going to let you express the information, import XPDL files, you know, the whole flexibility. And I think that's really critical now, is that we can't continue this model of creating structure, one team doing give and when then, some other team deciding to write an Excel spreadsheet full of data, which is not really that structured. You know, we have to pull that information together. The way we implement things, so whether or not we're using flex on one system, a mobile app on another, or testing some services, some WSDLs on another. You know, that can be done with different tools. That can be using SOAP UI. You know, that, I don't care what we use to test it, but at the end of the day, why we're testing it needs to be pulled back. And equally, those results of what happened when we did test it and the impact of that. So some web services are tested. Oh, actually, if I do this FX, financial exchange submission, it will crash, or, well, not use the word crash, but it'll give the wrong value. You know, partly those data models, that testing those data models are much more important than the front end, which is going to tell you exactly the same thing, or another application. And I use the word solution lifecycle management, because actually it's no longer one application. There's a number of products, number of services that all make up a end-to-end solution. They can't be tested in isolation. So, you know, that's typically a standard example for that.
So before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their automation efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
Sure. So that's a good question. It's quite a hard question in the same time kind of thing. I guess, you know, the question of why, you know, asking yourself why every single time you're doing something is really important. You know, why, until you kind of sensically understand why you've actually come down to that particular route in the first place. I think, you know, we're very passionate people. I think maybe it's because we're human beings. You know, we don't like to think that, you know, it's hard for people to tell us that our baby's ugly. You know, it's quite a difficult task to not love your framework for all its faults. Part of it is you need to find mentors that are going to give you that support, industry support, that say, hey, have you thought about this? Have you thought about, you know, looking at it in a slightly different way? I definitely have 6 different areas which I put onto. Alan Page gave me a list of what makes the perfect test automation script. You know, part of those is you can look them in those kind of multi dimensions and kind of understand whether or not what you was expecting, the goal of what you're trying to do, is actually being achieved or not. And I use the same kind of scorecard method each time. And the way I look at it is, you know, is it maintainable? You know, is it relevant? Has it got clear traceability back to business value? Is it reusable? Are they manageable? Is it something that can be scaled? Is it accessible? Can everyone access it across the company? Is it available to developers? Deployment, you know, that it's got, is it, or is it just an isolated script framework what's built into your test environment? Have you opened it up to look at reuse? Is it robust? You know, is it dealing with object event error handling kind of scenarios, you know, recovery when things go really badly wrong? You know, is it portable? You know, can you just pick that up, run that in a CI environment, and still it'll execute, or run against an environment with different configurations or an entirely different technology platform? Can you get the diagnostics information that you need out of it? So I talk about actionable insights. I talk about dynamic data adapters. Can you, does it pull all that information up that kind of allows you to do the TiVo world of it and rewind a few steps and say, I see that the database went offline. That's why I'm getting this error at the middleware. And I also can see at the front end, and this is why this code's come up. You know, I've got that view, not just a screenshot. I've got real information that I can send to a developer to reproduce it. And, you know, that's the way. And, you know, those scorecard components, which are, again, I don't go into too much, but, you know, platform technology, data source, test type, test approach, the class identification technology, the continuous building integration, the maintenance, all those kind of things are the basic ones to look at. You know, part of it is there's lots of exciting challenges out there. Go and learn. But, you know, my biggest tip out of all these tips would be when you're searching for information, whether or not you're using Google or you're trying to read some articles, is look at the date of when this stuff was written. Because I kind of typically only search for the stuff on Google within the last 24 hours, because some of it is the way that technology changes so rapidly is you want the most latest information. Equally, you know, part of your responsibility is to actually put that information back out there, you know, to share your success, share your ideas, share your patterns. Because this is the test community. This is the whole idea behind it, is we want to share what's worked, what's not worked, and ideas that help drive it to the next level, really.
Awesome. Great advice. And Jonathan, so how can we get in touch with you?
Okay, so the project which I was talking about originally, which was Test Automation as a Service, that's TAS.net, so it's TAAS.net. That's an open source collaboration platform, project we've been working on CodePlex, and gives you an idea of all this kind of architecture if you're interested in Test Automation as a Service. Myself, you know, you can get me on my website, which is automation.org.uk. But also, if you want to add me on LinkedIn, which, you know, I'm more than happy to talk to people on LinkedIn. I know the way me and Joe got in touch was Twitter, but, you know, you can go to linkedin.com/in/automation. That'll take you to my profile, or you can send me a tweet at Jonathan_Wright. You'll be able to get me one of those ways. And as Joe will know, you know, it doesn't take much to start those conversations off. And like I said, I'm always happy to talk to anybody about any of their problems. I try my utter best to make myself available and turn those around, you know, as quickly as possible.
Thanks, Jonathan, for your testing and automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to www.testtalks.com/38. While you're there, do you know who already has an awesome, must-have cloud-based testing service? Sauce Labs. Be sure to check them out by clicking on the More Info link under the exclusive sponsors section. Also, I would love it if you had a second to leave a review in iTunes. Those go a long way in terms of exposure and helping new people come along and see that this show is worthwhile. It also helps me to stay motivated and to learn what is working, and just as important, not working on the show. That's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.